stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie. On this week's The Space Show, NASA's big new moon rocket was not even a fizzer. It didn't get to that stage on Monday night. But we're expecting our man at the Kennedy Space Center to call in with a full report. Fingers crossed for that. And after our chat, we continue from last week's report on the science instruments to be carried by the Artemis 1 mission. In fact, we might do that before we talk to Angelo. So, let's go.
Let's take a trip to the moon. Come on, let's go for the moon. I wanna go to the moon. Let's take a trip to the moon.
On Monday evening, Australian Eastern Standard Time, they put some fuel in the Space Launch System rocket. What a name. Hate that name. Space SLS, Space Launch System. Anyway, it's a 100-meter tall rocket, and its aim is to launch astronauts to the moon and perhaps even beyond in future years. So what happened? Well, here at the Kennedy Space Center, it was overnight fueling. And this is the report that came in at midnight, American Eastern Daylight Time.
I want to start you off with the news of the morning, I should say, as we just turned to midnight, or rather midnight. The mission management team just met and gave a go to proceed with tanking for the Artemis 1 mission. Good news, the launch team has been doing their pre-cryoloading operations. They are substantially complete, looking on target to get started here. Artemis 1 launch director, Charlie Blackwell Thompson, is expected to give her go to tanking any moment now.
And she did that, and they began loading. About halfway through the loading, we had this report.
T-minus 5 hours and 19 minutes and counting here at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida at Launch Complex 39B, the SLS rocket and Orion spacecraft. On the pad, we are currently in the midst of cryoloading. We are filling both of the largest propellant tanks in the world, which are contained in the core stage at the center of the rockets. The liquid hydrogen is pumped into the rocket from a cryosphere nearby. LH2 is also fed from a cryosphere, but no pumps are required. It's extremely light. It can use the natural pressure by vaporizing some of the fluid in the tank, and that is enough to push that extremely light liquid hydrogen into the tank.
And they finally got the tank all fueled up. And then there was time to test the engines by cooling them down. But that's when the big problem began to happen.
6 a.m. Eastern Time here at Launch Complex 39B, where the launch team is continuing to progress through their procedures and configuration of the Space Launch System for launch. We are in the midst of an engine bleed, currently running liquid hydrogen through those engines in order to condition them for launch, get them to the right temperatures. The LH2 team reporting to the NASA test director that they get good bleed on three of the engines, but for engine number three, with not quite getting the bleed that they need to see there. So the team is working some troubleshooting on that issue. One of the things they're doing is pressing the tank to see if they can increase the pressure on the overall bleed and get that bleed flow through number three going a little bit better.
By pressing the tank, they mean pressurizing the tank, putting a bit more pressure on the fuel line. Well, we hung on, and it was looking increasingly unlikely that there would be a launch that day. There were weather problems as well, and eventually we had this report.
This is Artemis Launch Control with an update. Launch Director Charlie Blackwell Thompson has called a scrub for today. Again, Launch Director Charlie Blackwell Thompson has called a scrub of the attempt of launch of Artemis 1 and the Space Launch System with the Orion spacecraft. The issue that came up was an engine bleed that couldn't be remedied, but the rocket is currently in a stable configuration. It was mostly tanked, but not completely tanked. Engineers are now working on a plan to continue gathering data about this particular engine and the bleed that didn't work out. The hydrogen bleed, rather, was a goal of the previous wet dress rehearsal that didn't happen due to a hydrogen leak. So engineers are focused on gathering as much data as they can at this time. So they have not gone to draining the rocket just yet. They're going to keep it in its current configuration and gather that data. To summarize, we held at T-minus 40 minutes and counting.
And that was it. So, went to bed. This morning, there was a briefing. And this morning, our time. And launch status was given by Mike Sarafin, who is the Artemis 1 mission manager from NASA headquarters. This is what he had to say.
As you recall from yesterday, we had a couple of challenges that we encountered, and that ultimately ended up in a scrub of the first launch attempt for Artemis 1. The day began with some weather challenges that delayed the start of tanking. And then once we got into the cryogenic loading of the vehicle, we encountered a leak at the tail service mast umbilical on the hydrogen side at the 8-inch quick disconnect. The team managed to work its way through loading the core stage and the upper stage in spite of that leak. And we got a fully loaded vehicle and went into the engine bleed demonstration and attempted to do the thermal conditioning of the RS-25 engines, but we were unable to get the engines within the thermal conditions required to commit to launch. That was something that we knew about coming out of the agency flight readiness review, that we would demonstrate that the first time in the launch countdown, and we knew that that was a risk to being able to successfully attempt a launch that day. In combination with that, we also had a vent valve issue on the core stage, and it was at that point that the team decided to knock off the launch attempt for that day. Since that time, the team has rested, and along with thousands of others, our operations teams, our engineers, and folks got a good night's sleep. We came back and reviewed the data from Monday's launch attempt, and met today as a mission management team with our operations and engineering teams at 3 p.m. Eastern time, and here's what we agreed on. We agreed on what was called option one, which was to operationally change the loading procedure and start our engine chill down earlier. We also agreed to do some work at the pad address the leak that we saw at the hydrogen tail service mast umbilical, and we also agreed to move our launch date to Saturday, September the 3rd. We are going to reconvene the mission management team on Thursday, September the 1st, to review our flight rationale and our overall readiness. So that's where we got to today.
So we are going to have to wait for the Space Launch System to send its payloads and dummy astronauts off to the moon. So, nothing to do but wait. So, why don't we hear a little sting here about our new series that's available online, the Lunar Science Series. Lunar Science.
surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers like powdered charcoal to the sole and sides of my boots. But I can see footprint of my boots and the tread in the fine sandy particles.
Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. Yes, the space show is pleased to announce a new 54-part series called Lunar Science. This is not about spaceships and astronauts. It is about the science to be done on and near the Moon during the Artemis Project and the supporting unmanned missions. To find these programs, visit space.southernfm.com.au. Then scroll down until you see the Lunar Science link. Once again, Lunar Science is available online at space.southernfm.com.au.
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
This is the space show, and well, in America right now, and at Florida at the Kennedy Space Center, it's probably approaching a quarter past, what, five in the morning, three in the morning, something like that. Anyway, it's very late. Or very early, however you look at it, for Angelo, and we're hoping he's going to call in. Not sure if the alarm will go off and get him there. Meanwhile, let's have a look at some of the experiments that are being carried aboard the Artemis 1 mission. We're going to hear from Thomas Berger, who's the principal investigator of Helga and Zohar. He's from the German Aerospace Agency.
I'd like to welcome you all here today for this very exciting mission. My name is Dr. Thomas Berger. I'm a physicist at the German Aerospace Center in Cologne. I work in the radiation biology department, and I'm the principal investigator for the MARE experiment. And as Ramona already pointed out, with the NASA Artemis 1 mission, we are heading out into free space. So we're leaving the protection of the Earth's magnetic field, and we're traveling into a more harsh radiation environment. And to gather information about the radiation risks on humans, we are going to fly the MARE experiment as part of one of the secondary payloads inside the Orion crew module. MARE consists of two female anthropomorphic phantoms, so phantoms which reassemble a human. And the advantage of having female phantoms is that we are capable of placing radiation detectors at distinct points in each of the phantom to determine how much radiation is received within the relevant organs. So for example, we will place over 6,000 small radiation detectors in each of the two phantoms, which will enable us at the end to get a three-dimensional distribution of the radiation dose received by these two phantoms on their way to the moon and back. In addition, the phantoms will be equipped with battery-powered radiation detectors from NASA and from the German Aerospace Center. And the question is, why do we have two phantoms? We have one phantom, which is called Helga, and we have another phantom, which is called Zohar. They are in principle identical twins, but Zohar will wear, in addition, a radiation protection vest. And this radiation protection vest is provided by the Israel Space Agency funding Stemrad as a company. So we'll have one so-called unprotected Phantom flying in Orion, and the second Phantom, Sohar, will be protected with this radiation vest. So we'll use, in principle, the possibility to have these two Phantoms in Orion to measure not only the radiation load they will receive, but to test also possible new radiation protection measures.
Ramona Garza was mentioned there. She's the MARE science team lead at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, and she had more to say about the radiation experiments aboard the Artemis 1 mission.
Hello, everyone. Really glad to be here today with all of you and share some insight into the radiation environment challenges pertinent to human space exploration outside low Earth orbit. I'm Dr. Ramona Garza, a physicist with the Space Radiation Analysis Group at Johnson Space Center and working on protecting our crew from space radiation. My duties here include project management for the NASA's Crew Active Dosimeter, the new generation Crew-1 detector for Artemis 2 and beyond, and Human Health and Performance Science Team Lead for the Matryoshka Astro-Red Radiation Experiment, or MARE, a secondary payload on Artemis 1. In a moment, you will hear from other scientists and engineers on the call today who are leading out investigations that will provide valuable insight and further our knowledge and understanding about the effects of deep space radiation. First, I'll just give you a few words on the environment and biological effects. Throughout its journey to the moon and back, the Orion vehicle is left without the inherited protection of the Earth's magnetic field and is subject to the omnipresent galactic cosmic rays and the intense Van Allen radiation belts. This will result in an increased risk to the crew. When it comes to biological effects, different organs have different susceptibilities to space radiation. Understanding this effect is very important for successful and sustainable human space exploration efforts in deep space. Therefore, the uncrewed Artemis 1 flight offers this unique opportunity for scientific studies ranging from developing a detailed radiation dose mapping for different human body organs, the MARE payload, understanding the effects of space radiation on living organisms, including Eastern fungi, the BioExperiment 1 payload, developing a biosensor instrument to detect and measure such effects, the BioSentinel payload, and using deployable CubeSats equipped with instruments to study space weather effects in the interplanetary space and their impacts on Earth, the CASP payload. Last but not least, I would like to mention the three purposeful passengers inside Orion. Probably most of you heard yesterday's telecon that touched on the Munichin Commander Campos, who will sit in the commander seat and is equipped with sensors to provide data on what future Artemis astronauts may experience on their trip to the moon. Campos will be joined by two Phantom torsos. The MARE passengers, called Helga and Zohar, will be each equipped with a multitude of detectors to determine the radiation risk to the crew.
We'll have more about Artemis 1.
Southern FM.
The sounds of the Bayside.
Where we are looking at some of the radiation payloads to be carried aboard the Artemis 1 mission. If we're ever to go to Mars, radiation is one of the big problems to be solved. Likewise, if people are to spend long times on the lunar surface, again, we need to know about radiation. Well, Cherie Schwartz is the director of AstroRad, and she's with a company called Stemrad. And, well, they have an interest in this Artemis mission.
So I will be speaking about the AstroRad. The AstroRad vest is a personal protective wearable equipment that shields the astronauts from radiation during solar particle events, also known as solar storms. And storms in space can last for days and even weeks. So the AstroRad could potentially enable the crew to perform the daily activities even during a solar storm while being protected by the vest. MARE experiment's main goal is to evaluate the effectiveness of the AstroRad vest in protecting the astronauts from solar energy particles. It will be done by comparing the radiation values absorbed by Zohar, protected by the vest, to those of Helga. The inner unique protective cores are made of thousands of high-density polyethylene-made hexagons. The hexagons are connected to form a solid and yet flexible structure. This unique design allows for flexible movements and comfort of the user. The polyethylene material was chosen since it's high in hydrogen, and hydrogen is the most effective element for shielding charged particle radiation like solar protons. The vest also uses the selective shielding principle, which means more protection over sensitive organs. And our aim is to maximize the protection of critical organs while optimizing for weight. I will also add that the request to design the Astrovest vest for women came from NASA, as women in generally have a higher risk of developing cancer since they have more radiation-sensitive organs such as breast tissue and ovaries. Based on the results of two experiments currently being conducted, ergonomic and the radiation, we'll be able to finalize the design and provide optimal and comfortable protection for astronauts. And hopefully, the astronaut vest can enable continued exploration of deep space while maintaining crew health.
At a press conference last week, Ramona Garza was asked on the radiation limits for men and women.
Jennifer Whip with Nature Magazine.
Thanks for taking my question. It's for Ramona Garza. I wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit more broadly about gender differences in radiation risk throughout the Artemis program. So Artemis 1, of course, will be uncrewed, but as we move into crewed flights, maybe having astronauts at Gateway, having extended lunar surface operations, how much do we know about the increased risk that women experience in the space environment and especially beyond the Van Allen belts, and what research still needs to be done to better quantify how vulnerable women astronauts are, in particular non-male astronauts on the surface?
Hi, Alexandra. Sure. Let me try to give you a little bit of overview of how we do things on the International Space Station. So for the International Space Station, we have our limits based on the 3% risk in the risk of dying from a cancer caused by radiation exposure. And we have different limits based on gender and age on the International Space Station. Now, moving towards Moon and Mars, we are trying to consolidate those limits. And based on a recent report by the U.S. National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine that was released in June, we are encouraged to proceed in adopting a new standard that limits all astronauts, men and women, to a 600 millisieverts of radiation over their career. Now, when doing so and looking into developing this number, this threshold, we did look on allowing, with the new proposed standard, a limit that's valid for all astronauts, however, is based on what's allowable for a 35-year-old woman. So we are looking at the more conservative approach while we are making this uniform across the population. Moving outside low Earth orbit, definitely more studies are needed, and you heard a little bit about our biological studies happening. So as we explore space further, we hopefully would be able to gather more information on the differences. However, moving forward, this unified limit, we hope, will address conservative concerns about the risks of both women and men in space.
Our next question is from Marcia Smith with Space Policy Online.
Thanks so much. My question is for all of the scientists who are working on the gender differences that Alex was asking about initially in the radiation effects on women versus men. So Reid Weissman, the head of the astronaut office, has already said that NASA is no longer distinguishing between the male and female crew astronauts as in terms of radiation dosage. So I'm wondering if the results of these experiments are intended to change the design of Orion to provide better radiation protection, or to change what kind of protective equipment is on board Orion, including radiation vests or whatever, or is it to change the duration of the missions? Exactly how will this data be used, since the decision already apparently has been made that men and women will have the same radiation dosage limits.
Marcia, this is Ramona. I will take a hack at this question, of answering this question. The purpose of MARE, the MARE project, is actually to measure the dose of different body organs instead of inside the female phantom. So what we will get, besides the difference between a man and a woman when it comes to biological effect, we will get the difference between different body organs, difference between brain and uterus, for example, and other differences like that, or lung, or what are those differences. And of course, for the body organs that are common to both men and women, those relative differences in their response to space radiation will provide us with good information for both genders. So that's the purpose of the MARE project when it comes to studying body organs, right, and their susceptibility to space radiation. When it comes to the new limits being adopted, as I mentioned before, they are already being developed to look at the most conservative case, just to make sure we are not assuming risk that we may not be in a position to assume. And they are based on looking at the 35-year-old female limits, and you make it uniform for all.
Okay, thank you. We have another question. This will be from Irene Klotz with Aviation Week.
Thanks, Rachel. I have one, just kind of a clarification question for Ramona about the male-female radiation exposure. So, and I'm sorry if this sounds kind of blunt, but it seems that throughout all the history of the space program, at least since women were flying, there's been this acknowledgement that men are more resistant to the radiation environment than women, just genetically. And there was a decision made to basically level how many missions or how much exposure men and women can get, even though men physically are capable of withstanding more radiation. Is that correct? And was that decision like purely in the vein of, equality or flight opportunity equality, or is there any science that actually was behind the decision to make the radiation exposure limit even for men and for women?
This was based on science as well, considering the fact that although we did have studies in the past that showed discrepancies in different responses between female and male to radiation, they are not necessarily, how should I phrase this, 100% accepted by all scientists. So there are scientists out there, and if you look through the press, I'm sure you'll find articles and mentions of these scientists that will say, yes, for sure, this is an important factor and it should be considered in crew selection. And there are biology radiation scientists out there that they will say there is not enough conclusive scientific evidence that you have a significant impact due to radiation between men and women. So putting all of this together and looking forward to exploring outside low Earth orbit and looking forward at different approaches to make sure human exploration is possible and our crew is protected, the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine released this particular recommendation to NASA, and NASA is looking into adopting that recommendation, as you just said.
That was Ramona Garza. She is the MARE science team lead at the Johnson Space Center in Houston and answering reporters' questions there just last week. Now, let's take a musical interlude here. Back in the day, 50 years ago, we were flying missions to the moon in the Apollo program. Now, this singer saw the Apollo missions as a child and wanted to go there when he grew up. But the space race is now over, and he realizes that he will never go to the moon. So he has to contend himself with telling his son about the Apollo lunar missions. This is Audio Geist announcing that the space race is over.
Space race is over. You know what it's on about. Space race is over. You know it without a doubt. She calls this speck of dust her home. She's lived here years, you know, she's all alone. Frantic waiting by the phone, making sure she can hear the tone, hear the tone on the other end, on the other end. Well, she can just pretend, she can just pretend. Space race is over. Another has just begun. Space race is over. Space race is over. She knows she's already won, and she knows it's done.
That was Audio Geist with a song that predates the Artemis missions. And yes, the space race was over, but nowadays some people say there is a space race between the United States and China. Well, we can let you decide what you think of that. Now, let's go back to the Artemis payloads, and we're going to hear Sergio Santamaria. He is the lead scientist on an experiment called BioSentinel. He comes from the Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California. And yes, there are going to be life forms on the Artemis 1 mission. Let's hear about that now.
My name is Sergio Santamaria, or Sergio, if you want to try your Spanish. There is still a lot that we do not know about what will happen to biology when exposed to cosmic or solar radiation in deep space. This, of course, as highlighted by Yi, not only applies to humans, but all other life forms that will support future space exploration, such as plants and a variety of microorganisms. NASA's BioSentinel mission will perform the first long-duration biology experiment in deep space. Among the 10 cubes that's currently sitting underneath Orion, BioSentinel is the only one carrying biology. The mission has two primary objectives. One, to develop the first instrument capable of sustaining biological life in deep space. And second, to investigate the biological response to the deep space radiation environment. For this purpose, we selected the yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae, commonly known as budding or brewer's yeast, the same one we use to make bread or beer. This model organism, while very simple, shares many processes with human cells, particularly on how they repair DNA damage. Are there any other particular reasons why we selected yeast? Sure. besides being used extensively in fundamental and biomedical research, it has been flown to space many times. It is easy to manipulate genetically, and most importantly, it can be dried and kept alive for a long time in this state, just like the yeast you buy at the grocery market. Our CubeSat carries two scientific instruments, a fluidic-based system named biosensor, which delivers nutrients to rehydrate yeast once biosentinel reaches its orbit around the sun. The yeast cells will be activated at different time points throughout the six-month nominal mission. This instrument tracks cell activity using an optical detection system. The second instrument, a radiation spectrometer, will quantify the amount of space radiation and identify the types of particles hitting the CubeSat. And this information will be correlated to the biological response. Thus, BioSentinel aims to fill critical knowledge gaps about the effects of the deep space radiation environment on biology by using a very simple microbial organism. We hope that we can extrapolate our results to human biology and inform on potential countermeasures for future crew missions. Furthermore, these effects will be compared to data obtained on board the International Space Station and on the ground.
And this is the Space Show.
88.3 Southern FM.
On air and online via the free Community Radio Plus app. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play.
I saw the crescent.
The Space Show, looking at the Artemis 1 mission. Dustin Gomet is the project manager of Orion Crew Survival Systems at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. And he had this to say last week about the mannequin in a space suit.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. We're here at JSC. We're pretty excited right now for the launch of the Orion Artemis 1 mission. As you know, this is going to be our first mission as we plan to return for a permanent human presence on the moon and one day beyond. The interesting thing to prepare ourselves for this mission, we have a pretty unique payload on board. We're going to be launching a suit, the Orion Crew Survival Suit, on a suited mannequin. That's Commander Munikin Campos. And the goal is to simulate, test, evaluate the human experience of launch and landing. So Artemis 1 is uncrewed, but with the mannequin, we'll be able to evaluate how that human behaves on the vehicle. This spacesuit that we have, the Orion Crew Survival Suit, or OCSS, or OX, if you even want to go shorter than that, will be worn by all the future astronauts from Artemis 2 and beyond on all the subsequent missions. The function of this suit is pretty interesting. You can almost think of it as a personalized spacecraft, a secondary but much more personalized spacecraft that protects the crew member, provides them pressure, oxygen, cooling, and any other life-sustaining functions that are needed. The novel aspect of this suit versus any suits we've flown before is that it's designed to sustain a crew member for up to 6 days in the event of a contingency. That's a feat we've never before attempted in the history of spacesuits. I mentioned earlier Commander Munikin Campos. So the mannequin on board, named after the legendary Apollo engineer Arturo Campos, he'll be riding aboard in the suit on board Orion in a fully flight-like seat. It's designed with advanced occupant safety features that we've incorporated through really the last decade of study. And we've done that to maximize human safety. The NASA Crew Survival Engineering team, that's our team that runs the OX program, we've spent this last decade working to create a fully integrated crew safety system. And to do that, we had to combine the vehicle, the suit, the seat, and the human all into one protective package. With this mission, we're going to measure some of the important aspects of those launch safety features. And with the mannequin, we'll be able to look at the dynamic responses of that system. Well, this is important because it allows us to take what we've learned from testing and from modeling and validate that against the real-world performance so that we can ensure the safety of all the future astronauts.
Rob Chambers is the director of the Commercial Civil Space Strategy at the company Lockheed Martin. And, well, the topic of discussion was Amazon's Alexa.
I'm happy to talk today a little bit about Callisto, which is a 100% industry-funded technology demonstration that will be flying inside the Orion crew module throughout the mission. This is a joint activity by Lockheed Martin, Amazon, and Cisco, who have been fantastic partners. And we're focused on testing out the next generation of crew interface capabilities to see if they would be useful and how they would be useful as we move further out into the solar system for increasing the crew's situational and awareness and their efficiency within the spacecraft. We're leveraging commercial technology, which I'll describe in just a moment. And in fact, these commercial technologies that we're extending along with our partners actually provide real benefit to some of the technologies back here on Earth, and I will touch on that. In addition to the industry funding of our efforts, we've also worked with NASA using a reimbursable Space Act agreement. So again, this is 100% commercial industry funded, and we really appreciate the support NASA has given through that reimbursable Space Act agreement. So the objective of this technology demonstration throughout the mission is to look at three things. First, voice control. We are flying a customized version of the Amazon Alexa device. We worked hard, and I'll say that hats off to the engineers at Cisco and Amazon and here at Lockheed Martin. I would walk into the room and not know who worked for whom because of the collaboration. We had to create with Amazon a version of Alexa that could operate on the far side of the moon without connection to the internet, which is how here on Earth the Alexa devices normally operate. But as I noted, these are technology extensions that are useful back here on Earth. And so this is very similar to the hybrid voice control or remote aspects of Alexa where she operates without interfaces back to the internet. So it's a far distance to telecommute from the other side of the moon, but that's what this Alexa voice device will allow us to do. It has access to, they have access to the telemetry stream within Orion, and we'll be able to query state of the spacecraft and status, and also provide some very simplified commands that can control the lights in the cabin. And that's to very controlled so that we have no impact on the mission, but it allows us to test out those command interfaces. And again, the use case for this would be in the future, we're evaluating could astronauts use this to interact with the spacecraft more efficiently and more naturally as we do things here on Earth that can be simplified. The second piece of what we're attempting to test out with this technology demonstration are collaboration tools between mission control and the spacecraft. As the crew moves out further and further into the solar system, of course, there's no crew on Artemis 1, but we can test out tools that could be used in the future. So WebEx by Cisco has provided amazing customized, minor customizations, but as you can guess, there are still some. This is not the stock teleconference or video conference activity to accommodate the delays out to the other side of the moon and all the interfaces to keep them secure that the MCC has with the Deep Space Network and TDRS and other types of communications interfaces. So there are two aspects to that. One is a WebEx video conference session that we'll be able to conduct. The WebEx software is installed on a commercial tablet that will be in the crew cabin. And via the cameras and our interactions with Alexa, we'll be able to provide a mission control center to spacecraft video conference activity that will allow us to test out that two-way communication. And then the second part of that collaboration set of activities is the WebEx board that allows us to You know, whenever engineers need to solve a problem, the first thing we do is pick up the pen and the whiteboard and start solving. We will be able to do that on this mission thanks to the Cisco board capability, and we'll be testing out how that could be used in the future when crew is actually on board. And then the third part of the mission testing that we're performing is commercial and high-definition cameras and lights. We had to install those so we could monitor the success of the technology demo. That includes a 360 virtual reality camera that'll give us a inside view of the spacecraft. And I, for one, am looking forward after the mission to see what reentry looked like from the right shoulder of Campos. The reason for those is to evaluate the success of our technology demo, since we don't have anyone on board. But that also makes it super, super visible for the rest of the country and for the world. So we'll be conducting two-hour sessions with STEM sessions as we test out the payload and as we test out those technologies.
It looks like our expected guest from Florida is having a well-deserved sleep-in. So we're going to go to something we recorded at Federation Square with the Moon Village Association.
Dr. Omar Eduardo Rodriguez, like myself, he's a medical doctor working in psychiatry. He's currently a neuroradiology registrar at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and a pre-fellow of the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. He completed a Bachelor of Medicine and Economics and then went on to become a Director of Management and Development at St. John of God Health Organization. Then after a few years, decided to pursue his lifelong aspiration in the space industry and neurosciences. Then he pursued pilot training as well as completed a Master's in Space Studies with the International Space University in France. Then in 2017, he enrolled in the Southern Hemisphere Space Studies program, which is held annually in Adelaide, which quite a few people in the room, I think, are graduates of. He is a former scholar and researcher from NASA Ames, where he worked in the Fatigue Countermeasures Laboratory. He also participated in a Mars medical analog mission as crew health and neuropsychiatry officer. He was also selected by the International Institute for Astronautical Science in the United States as a scientist astronaut candidate, and his research interests are in fatigue, sleep studies, and the broader neuropsychiatry aspects of space in analog missions and in parabolic flight. Dr. Rodriguez is going to take a slightly different tact as he speaks about a very important but often overlooked area of human spaceflight, that of being confined in a spacecraft, being surrounded by the dangers of a different environment, and the immense toll this takes on the psychological health of astronauts, which can place the entire mission in jeopardy if not managed properly.
Okay, my objective with this presentation is to identify some neurological, psychological, and psychiatric aspects in space exploration, particularly in the moon, and to recognize what are the problems that we will face in case that we colonize the moon or Mars. So, as a human beings, we have been in a process of evolution. We have been, you know, in the jungle, then we conquer the cities, we conquer different worlds here in the air, we conquer different continents, and this is part of our inner soul to go beyond. As I say, Constantine, air is the cradle of humanity, but one cannot live in a cradle forever. So let's go to think for 1 second. Let's go to think that you are going to camping. You will feel anxious to go for camping? What will be the fears that you will have if you go for camping? Just let's go to think for a few seconds. You are going to camping to the mountains. What will you bring with you? What will be the fear that you are in the mountains? You are fear for animals, you are fear for be sick, be far away from home. Okay, let's go to say, we are going to be to the mountains, to the Everest, to the Himalayas. You know, high altitude, I need to be scared, you know. Okay, now you are going to the Antarctic. What will be the fear that you have? a little bit more scary. You know, you get sick, what happened? So there are so many stress that we had to face. So for 1 second, let's go to say that we are going to the moon, okay? And let's go to try to experience what would be our fears. Now I want to ask you guys, what do you feel if you are going to the moon? What would you feel if you are in the rocket? Just feel free to say. Lost. Lucky. Okay, very lucky. Okay. Any other emotions? Scared. Very scared. Why scared? Exactly, we don't know, you know. Any other feelings? Adrenaline, yeah, I can imagine, you know. So let's go for 1 second. You're in the rocket and you feel all the vibration, the noise. You know, you don't know what happened. Anything could be wrong, you know. This is the stress that actually astronauts are going to experience. And actually it's going to impact into the mental stability. So as Gordon said before, there are different elements. One is the confinement. So you know that when you are here in the air, we will have our own space. When you are in the moon, on space, there is no more. We lost this like privacy. You know, everyone knows what you are doing. And you have to share your own emotions with other people. How you feel about that? How about the isolation? You sometimes feel your family when you are far away, when you are in a trip. You know, what happens if you are in the mountains? Maybe you feel your family. What happens if you go to the moon and you will be there for quite a long period of time? You could be very isolated and can take really impact into your emotional state. And they can maybe feel people to feel depressed. How about the, you know, low gravity, you know, the impact into the into all our body fluids, how they can change our physiology. They also can impact into our mental state. Different risks. As you say, someone say, you know, it's scary. Of course it's scary. Because we can die, and always we face the situation that if something is going wrong, we can die very easily. So we are going to explore the unknown. So this continual risk is going to affect our emotion as well. Of course, stress, because you have a lot of responsibility to be in space. And you can be sick, because it costs a lot of money to put some weight there. So a continuous stress that you have to perform at a high level, and the expectation of people that you have to accomplish, you know, your goals over there. The stress that, you know, asteroid impact, the stress that the machine is not working, the stress that you are far away from family, the stress that you have new food. There are so many stresses that you are experiencing every day. The radiation, as I said before, you know, we don't know what happened in deep space exploration, but some research has shown that animal mice, they can get Alzheimer's when they are in space because of the high radiation. So we don't know what happened. Maybe we send one to moon, and after 1 week, 2 weeks, the radiation really can damage the brain. The sleep is another problem, you know. We're here in our home, we have our comfortable bed, we have some 8 hours, okay? What happened? We are in the space, our sleep is completely changed, you know. One day in the moon, how long does it take 1 day in the moon? 14 days is around 28 days, I think, by memory, 28 days. I mean, 28, exactly. Yeah. So we change completely our circadian cycle, you know. Our pattern of sleeping day and night is changed. And we know from research that when the sleeping change, when our sleeping pattern change, we have more tendency to have mental problems. So one of the main aspects in space is the cognition. Our cognition deteriorates because all these stresses, as I said before. So we can perform at the level that we do here in the air. There is a high risk of suffering from depression. So far, there is only one case have been reported in the International Space Station. But in long term, there is a high chance. And we know that in analog missions, and like in Antarctic or in submarine, we know that 5% of the people suffer from major mental illnesses. So even though we don't know, there is a high chance that the astronauts, they can suffer from depression. And one of the problems is that we are expecting the astronauts to report the problems. And many times they don't report. So they hide this information. So in fact, we don't know if they are depressed or not. Another problem is all the psychological illness. So far we don't have any astronaut who have been suffering from a psychotic illness or mania at the moment, but we don't know in long-term space exploration. Psychological phenomena, there are different aspects in the space, as you know, as you can guess, as you can feel it, just for 1 second, you are thinking you are in space. One is the adjustment reaction, which is the normal adjustment that everyone suffers to a new environment. And they have to suffer that, and we know they suffer. There are one case report, an astronaut suffered from some autoformal disorder. He thought that his teeth were falling out, and he was very, very sure that it would happen. When he came out to air, he was fine. And another problem is suicidality. There is not any report so far, I couldn't find it, that any report of suicidality. But as I said before, many information is hiding, so we don't know yet. Now the social aspect. You are living in a very small space, sharing this with 3 or 4 people that you don't know. Maybe they are different cultures, different countries, different background, different language. How you can deal with this in long period of time, and how they can affect into the performance. And there are different analog missions, like one is the 500 Days Mars, which has different papers has been writing about this. What happens when you are living in this environment, sharing with other people? All the dynamics, you know, all the leadership, all the anger, all the frustration, how you can deal this with other people. So message just to take home. We know that it's our dream to go. It's not easy. As we discussed in November 2017, the Field Moon Village meeting, it's a long way to go to make safe to the human to be in space, and particularly to be safe and cognitively, and to be safe that the astronaut is able to perform in a high level. The good point with this is that there are different research. When I was in NASA, we were working particularly in sleeping issues and to see how we can predict fatigue in astronauts in space. And all this technology, by sure, in 10, 20 years, we can use this technology in our everyday life. So this is one of the dreams that I have, that everything that we develop for space, we are going to use in the air, here in our everyday life in the future. Okay, that's it. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you enjoy this. Thank you.
And there we must leave. Omar Rodriguez from the Royal Melbourne Hospital.